This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Radical King, written by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., edited by Cornell West. Performed by Cornell West, LeVar Burton, Mike Coulter, Coleman Domingo, Kevin R. Free, Danny Glover, Robin Miles, Leslie Odom, Jr., Gabourey Sidibe, Wanda Sykes, Bonnie Turpin, and Michael Kenneth Williams.
Introduction. The Radical King We Don't Know. The FBI transcript of a June 27, 1964 phone conversation reveals Malcolm X receiving a message from Martin Luther King, Jr. This message supported the idea of getting the Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations to expose the unfair, vicious treatment of black people in America. Malcolm X replied that he was eager to meet Martin Luther King Jr. as soon as the next afternoon. If they had met that day and worked together, the Radical King would be well known. In a speech to staff in 1966, King explained, "There must be a better distribution of wealth, and maybe America must move toward a democratic socialism." If he had lived and pursued this project, the Radical King would be well known. On April 4th, 1968 in Memphis, the last day of his life, Martin Luther King, Jr. phoned Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta with the title of his Sunday sermon, "Why America May Go to Hell." If he had preached this sermon, the Radical King would be well known. Yet in Dr. King's own time, he would say repeatedly, "I am nevertheless greatly saddened that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment, or my calling." It is no accident that just prior to King's death, 72% of whites and 55% of blacks disapproved of his opposition to the Vietnam War and his efforts to eradicate poverty in America. When much of the black leadership attacked or shunned him, King replied, "What you're saying may get you a foundation grant, but it won't get you into the kingdom of truth." In short, Martin Luther King Jr. refused to sell his soul for a mess of pottage. He refused to silence his voice in his quest for unarmed truth and unconditional love. For King, the condition of truth was to allow suffering to speak. For him, justice was what love looks like in public. In King's eyes, too many black leaders sacrificed the truth for access to power or reduced sacrificial love and service to selfish expediency and personal gain. This spiritual blackout among black leaders resulted in their use and abuse by the white political and economic establishment that constituted a kind of conspiracy against the poor. This spiritual blackout, this lack of integrity and courage, primarily revealed a deep fear, failure of nerve, and spinelessness on behalf of black leaders. They too often were sycophants, cheerleaders, or bootlickers for big-moneyed interests, even as the boots were crushing poor and working people. In stark contrast to this cowardice, King stated to his staff, "I'd rather be dead than afraid." Although much of America did not know the Radical King, and too few know him today, the FBI and U.S. government did. They called him the most dangerous man in America. They knew Reverend King was a revolutionary Christian sincere in his commitment and serious in his calling. They knew he was a product of a black prophetic tradition full of fire in his bones, love in his heart, light in his mind, and courage in his soul. Martin Luther King Jr. was the major threat to the U.S. government and the American establishment because he dared to organize and mobilize black rage over past and present crimes against humanity, targeting black folk and other oppressed people. Any such black awakening can either yield hatred and revenge or love and justice. This is why the prophetic words of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel still haunt us. The whole future of America will depend upon the impact and influence of Dr. King. The fundamental question is, does America have the capacity to hear and heed the radical King, or must America sanitize King in order to evade and avoid his challenge? King indeed had a dream, but it was not the American dream. King's dream was rooted in the American dream. It was what the quest for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness looked like for people enslaved in Jim Crow, terrorized, traumatized, and stigmatized by American laws and American citizens. The litmus test for realizing King's dream was neither a black face in the White House nor a black presence on Wall Street. Rather, the fulfillment of his dream was for all poor and working people to live lives of decency and dignity. King's dream of a more free and democratic America and world has morphed into, in his own words, a nightmare, owing to the persistence of racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. He called America a sick society. At one point, King cried out in despair, "I have found out that all that I have been doing in trying to correct this system in America has been in vain. I was trying to get at the roots of it to see just what ought to be done. The whole thing will have to be done away with." He said to his dear brother Harry Belafonte days before his, King's, death, "Are we integrating into a burning house?" He was weary of pervasive economic injustice, cultural decay, and political paralysis. He was not an American given chronicling the decline and fall of the American empire, but a courageous and visionary Christian blues man fighting with style and love in the face of the four catastrophes he identified, which are still with us today. Militarism is an imperial catastrophe that has produced a military-industrial complex and national security state and warped the country's priorities and stature, as with the immoral drones dropping bombs on innocent civilians. Materialism is a spiritual catastrophe promoted by a corporate media multiplex and a culture industry that has hardened the hearts of hardcore consumers and coarsened the consciences of would-be citizens. Clever gimmicks of mass distraction yield a cheap soul craft of addicted and self-medicated narcissists. Racism is a moral catastrophe, most graphically seen in the prison industrial complex and targeted police surveillance in black and brown ghettos rendered invisible in public discourse. Arbitrary uses of the law in the name of the war on drugs have produced, in legal scholar Michelle Alexander's well-known phrase, a new Jim Crow of mass incarceration. And poverty is an economic catastrophe inseparable from the power of greedy oligarchs and avaricious plutocrats, indifferent to the misery of poor children, elderly and disabled citizens, and working people. The radical king was a warrior for peace on the domestic and global battlefields. He was a staunch anti-colonial and anti-imperial thinker and fighter. His revolutionary commitment to nonviolent resistance in America and abroad tried to put a brake on the escalating militarism running amok across the globe. As a decade-long victim of the vicious and vindictive FBI, King was a radical libertarian as well as having closeted democratic socialist leanings. His commitment to the precious rights and liberties for all was profound. For King, dissent did not mean disloyalty. In fact, dissent was a high form of patriotism. When he said that the U.S. government was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, he was not trashing America. He was telling the painful truth about a country he loved. King was never anti-American. He was always anti-injustice in America and anywhere else. Love of truth and love of country could go hand in hand. The radical king was a spiritual giant who tried to shatter the callousness and indifference of his fellow citizens. Following his dear friend and comrade Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, King believed that indifference to evil is more evil than evil itself. And materialism, with its attendants, hedonism and egotism, produces sleepwalkers bereft of compassion and zombies deficient in love. This spiritual crisis is not reducible to politics or economics. It is rooted in the relative decline of integrity, honesty, decency, and virtue, due in large part to the role of big money in American life. This cold-hearted obsession with manipulation and domination drives our ecological catastrophe in the making and our possible military Armageddon. The radical king was a moral titan with profound allegiance to his roots, the black prophetic tradition and black freedom struggle. His genuine commitment to the dignity of whites as well as the peoples of all hues never overshadowed or downplayed his deep commitment to black people. For King, the struggle against the legacy of white supremacy was never a strategic move or tactical afterthought. Rather, it was a profound, existential, and moral matter of great urgency. King knew that white supremacy in various forms was a global phenomenon. It remained shot through our hearts and minds, institutions and structures, smartphones and unwise politicians. The modes of racist domination, from barbaric slavery to bestial Jim Crow Senior to cruel Jim Crow Junior, are never reducible to individual prejudice or personal bias. Empire, white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy, and homophobia are linked in complex ways, and our struggles against them require moral consistency and systemic analysis. The radical king was a democratic socialist who sided with poor and working people in the class struggle taking place in capitalist societies. This class struggle may be visible or invisible, manifest or latent, but it rages on in a fight over resources, power, and space. In the past 30 years, we have witnessed a top-down, one-sided class war against poor and working people in the name of a morally bankrupt policy of deregulating markets, lowering taxes, and cutting spending for those who are already socially neglected and economically abandoned. America's two main political parties, each beholden to big money, offer merely alternative versions of oligarchic rule. The radical king was neither Marxist nor communist, but he did understand the role of class analysis in his focus on poor and working people. He always had a healthy suspicion of all politicians of any color, owing to his critique of legalized bribery and normalized corruption in money-saturated American politics. He noted, "I have come to think of my role as one which operates outside the realm of partisan politics. I feel I should serve as a conscience of all the parties and all of the people." This critical attitude toward politicians was deepened when he worked to register thousands of people to elect the first black mayor in modern times, Carl Stokes, in Cleveland in 1967, yet was uninvited to join the stage for the victory celebration. The response of the radical king to our catastrophic moment can be put in one word: revolution. A revolution in our priorities, a reevaluation of our values, a reinvigoration of our public life, and a fundamental transformation of our way of thinking and living that promote a transfer of power from oligarchs and plutocrats to everyday people and ordinary citizens. The radical king was first and foremost a revolutionary Christian, a black Baptist minister and pastor whose intellectual genius and rhetorical power was deployed in the name of the gospel of Jesus Christ. King understood this good news to be primarily radical love in freedom and radical freedom in love, a fallible enactment of the beloved community or finite embodiment of the kingdom of God. King's radical love can be heard in John Coltrane's A Love Supreme or the Isley Brothers' Caravan of Love. This radical love of an intensely hated people is both liberating and contagious, just as this radical freedom of a thoroughly unfree people is both emancipating and infectious. The radical king was the most significant and effective organic intellectual in the latter half of the 20th century whose fundamental motif was radical love. King's radical love was Christocentric in content and black in character. Like the Christocentric language of the black church that produced the radical king, Jesus, as the bright and morning star against the backdrop of the pitch darkness of the night, as water in dry places, the companion in loneliness, a doctor to the sick, a rock in a weary land. His Christocentrism exemplifies the intimate and dependent relationship between God and person and between God and a world-forsaken people. The black character of King's radical love was its roots in the indescribable terror and inimitable trauma of being black in white supremacist America during slavery, Jim Crow Sr. or Jim Crow Jr. King's work and witness is a kind of prophetic pneumatology in motion, a kinetic orality, passionate physicality, and combative spirituality that wedded mind to movement, soul to sustenance, and body to empowerment. Like his most worthy theological precursor, Howard Thurman, King pulled from the rich insights of Western thinkers, yet he elevated the lived experiences of wounded, scarred, and bruised bodies of enslaved and Jim Crowed black peoples to enact radical love. King's radical love put a premium on artistic performance and existential praxis. His sermons were performances that authorized an alternative reality to the way the world is. His living radiated a radical tenderness, subversive sweetness, and militant gentleness. He found great joy in serving others. Like his great contemporary Dorothy Day, the Catholic saint who looked at the world through the lens of her heart, Dr. King understood radical love as a form of death, a relentless self-examination in which a fearful, hateful, egoistic self dies daily to be reborn into a courageous, loving, and sacrificial self. For both Day and King, this radical love flows from an imitation of Christ, a response to an invitation of self-surrender in order to emerge fully equipped to fight for justice in a cold and cruel world of domination and exploitation. The scandal of the cross is precisely the unstoppable and unsuffocatable love that keeps moving in a blood-soaked history, even in our catastrophic times. There is no radical king without his commitment to radical love. This book unearths a radical king that we can no longer sanitize. His revolutionary witness, embodied in anti-imperial, anti-colonial, anti-racist, and democratic socialist sentiments, was grounded in his courage to think, his courage to love, and his courage to die. Could it be that we know so little of the radical king because such courage defies our market-driven world? Part 1, Radical Love. Radical love sits at the center of the radical king. All the individual success, professional achievement, sharp analysis, and strategic calculation are but sounding brass and tinkling cymbal without radical love. For King, radical love emerges from catastrophe, perseveres through crisis, and yields an indomitable spiritual center, a radical humility and radical integrity. In this collection's first essay, The Violence of Desperate Men, we see the source of King's radical love, his spiritual mountaintop experience in his kitchen in Montgomery, Alabama, just as he assumes leadership of the Montgomery Improvement Association. Following the pioneering work of David Garrow, James Cone, and Vincent Harding, I understand the radical king as a spiritual warrior equipped with Christian armor, willing to love, serve, and die for his people. Radical love requires the cowardly self to die in order for the courageous self to live daily. This death-in-life conversion sustains the self in the face of terror and trauma. King's kitchen experience is a kind of 9/11 moment. He and his precious family are unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence and hated for who he and they are. These 9/11 moments are integral to being black in America. King's loving parents, Martin and Alberta King, and supportive church and school, Ebenezer Baptist Church and Morehouse College, laid his strong foundations. But the love he received from them was radicalized, dipped in the dark pit of catastrophe, and tested in the fierce fire of crisis in Montgomery. His spiritual call for help came in the form of God's radical love for him. The major intellectual and practical challenge to King's radical love came from the critiques of religion put forward by Karl Marx and Friedrich Nietzsche. King spent much time wrestling with these figures in his studies and in his life. Marx's claim was that religion was the opiate of the people, the instrument of those who rule, in that it disinvests people of their own powers by investing God with all power, and thereby rendering them submissive and deferential toward the status quo. Nietzsche's view of Christian love as a form of resentment and revenge of the powerless and impotent toward the powerful and the strong led King briefly to despair of the power of love in solving social problems. Prophetic religion could empower people to fight against oppression and struggle for freedom, so Marx was only partly right. But could the love ethic of Jesus Christ be applied to groups, nations, or classes as well as to individuals? The Gandhian method of love-motivated, agapic, nonviolent resistance provided the radical king with a response to Marx and an answer to Nietzsche. Radical love was a moral and practical method, a way of life and a way of struggle in which oppressed people could fight for freedom without inflicting violence on the oppressor, humiliating the opponent, and hence possibly transforming the moral disposition of one's adversary. King's radical love, following Gandhi's great breakthrough, is often celebrated for his love of white oppressors. This misses the point. King's radical love of an often unloved people, black people, is the basis of his much-heralded love of white people. His radical love is inseparable from the radical freedom he wants for an unfree people and for all others. A fuller discussion of King's radical love requires a comparative analysis of Malcolm X's radical love or Ella Baker's radical love, just as Gandhi's radical love should be contrasted with Ambedkar's radical love. King's two sermons, Palm Sunday Sermon on Mahatma K. Gandhi and Loving Your Enemies, as well as his autobiographical Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, lay bare his profound and poignant hammering out the idea and practice of radical love. King was deeply concerned with bequeathing the rich tradition of radical love to the younger generation. He understood the deep insights of the black nationalist heritage represented by giants such as Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X, who highlighted black self-respect, black self-defense, and black self-determination. He also knew that his Southern Christian style did not always resonate with Northern urban youth, yet King always extended his radical love to them in a sincere and authentic way. In his speech to high school students in Philadelphia, we see another side of King, a love warrior focused on fostering black self-love in youth. Based on my own teaching, including work in high schools and prisons, I decided to end part one with King's more personal and intimate directive to black youth and their future. 1. The Violence of Desperate Men. The following is a chapter from Dr. King's memoir of the Montgomery Bus Boycott, Stride Toward Freedom, 1958, which King described as the chronicle of 50,000 Negroes who took to heart the principles of nonviolence, who learned to fight for their rights with the weapon of love, and who in the process acquired a new estimate of their own human worth.
After the Get Tough policy failed to stop the movement, the diehards became desperate, and we waited to see what their next move would be. Almost immediately after the protests started, we had begun to receive threatening telephone calls and letters. Sporadic in the beginning, they increased as time went on. By the middle of January, they had risen to 30 and 40 a day. Postcards, often signed KKK, said simply, "Get out of town or else." Many misspelled and crudely written letters presented religious half-truths to prove that God do not intend the white people and the Negro to go together. If he did, we would be the same. Others enclosed mimeographed and printed materials combining anti-Semitic and anti-Negro sentiments. One of these contained a handwritten postscript, "You niggers are getting yourself in a bad place. The Bible is strong for segregation, as of the Jews, Sikh, concerning other races. It is even for segregation between the 12 tribes of Israel. We need and will have a Hitler to get our country straightened out." Many of the letters were unprintable catalogs of blasphemy and obscenity. Meanwhile, the telephone rang all day and most of the night. Often, Coretta was alone in the house when the calls came, but the insulting voices did not spare her. Many times, the person on the other end simply waited until we answered and then hung up. A large percentage of the calls had sexual themes. One woman, whose voice I soon came to recognize, telephoned day after day to hurl her sexual accusations at the Negro. Whenever I tried to answer, as I frequently did, in an effort to explain our case calmly, the caller would cut me off. Occasionally, we would lead the telephone off the hook, but we could not do this for long, because we never knew when an important call would come in. When these incidents started, I took them in stride, feeling that they were the work of a few hotheads who would soon be discouraged when they discovered that we would not fight back. But as the weeks passed, I began to see that many of the threats were in earnest. Soon I felt myself faltering and growing in fear. One day a white friend told me that he had heard from reliable sources that plans were being made to take my life. For the first time, I realized that something could happen to me. One night at a mass meeting, I found myself saying, "If one day you find me sprawled out dead, I do not want you to retaliate with a single act of violence. I urge you to continue protesting with the same dignity and discipline you have shown so far." A strange silence came over the audience. Afterward, to the anxious group that gathered around, I tried to make light of the incident by saying that my words had not grown from any specific cause, but were just a general statement of principle that should guide our actions in the event of any fatality. But Ralph Abernathy was not satisfied. As he drove me home that night, he said, "Something is wrong. You are disturbed about something." I tried to evade the issue by repeating what I had just told the group at the church, but he persisted. "Martin," he said, "you are not talking about some general principle. You had something specific in mind." Unable to evade any longer, I admitted the truth. For the first time, I told him about the threats that were harassing my family. I told him about the conversation with my white friend. I told him about the fears that were creeping up on my soul. Ralph tried to reassure me, but I was still afraid. The threats continued. Almost every day someone warned me that he had overheard white men making plans to get rid of me. Almost every night I went to bed faced with the uncertainty of the next moment. In the morning I would look at Coretta and Yoki and say to myself, they can be taken away from me at any moment. I can be taken away from them at any moment. For once I did not even share my thoughts with Coretta. One night toward the end of January, I settled into bed late after a strenuous day. Coretta had already fallen asleep, and just as I was about to doze off, the telephone rang. An angry voice said, "Listen, nigger, we've taken all we want from you. Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to Montgomery." I hung up, but I couldn't sleep. It seemed that all of my fears had come down on me at once. I had reached the saturation point. I got out of bed and began to walk the floor. Finally, I went to the kitchen and heated a pot of coffee. I was ready to give up. With my cup of coffee sitting untouched before me, I tried to think of a way to move out of the picture without appearing a coward. In this state of exhaustion, when my courage had all but gone, I decided to take my problem to God. With my head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and prayed aloud. The words I spoke to God that midnight are still vivid in my memory. I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced him before. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, "Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for truth, and God will be at your side forever." Almost at once, my fears began to go. My uncertainty disappeared. I was ready to face anything. 3 nights later, on January 30th, I left home a little before 7 to attend our Monday evening mass meeting at the First Baptist Church. A member of my congregation, Mrs. Mary Lucy Williams, had come to the parsonage to keep my wife company in my absence. After putting the baby to bed, Coretta and Mrs. Williams went to the living room to look at television. About 9:30, they heard a noise in front that sounded as though someone had thrown a brick. In a matter of seconds, an explosion rocked the house. A bomb had gone off on the porch. The sound was heard many blocks away, and word of the bombing reached the mass meeting almost instantly. Toward the close of the meeting, as I stood on the platform helping to take the collection, I noticed an usher running to give Ralph Abernathy a message. Abernathy turned and ran downstairs, soon to reappear with a worried look on his face. Several others rushed in and out of the church. People looked at me and then away. One or two seemed about to approach me, and then changed their minds. An usher called me to the side of the platform, presumably to give me a message. But before I could get there, SSC had sent him away. By now I was convinced that whatever had happened affected me. I called Ralph Abernathy, SSC, and E.N. French, and asked them to tell me what was wrong. Ralph looked at C. and French, and then turned to me and said hesitantly, "Your house has been bombed." I asked if my wife and baby were all right. They said, "We are checking on that now." Strangely enough, I accepted the word of the bombing calmly. My religious experience a few nights before had given me the strength to face it. I interrupted the collection and asked all present to give me their undivided attention. After telling them why I had to leave, I urged each person to go straight home after the meeting and adhere strictly to our philosophy of nonviolence. I admonished them not to become panicky and lose their heads. Let us keep moving, I urged them, with the faith that what we are doing is right, and with the even greater faith that God is with us in the struggle. I was immediately driven home. As we neared this scene, I noticed hundreds of people with angry faces in front of the house. The policemen were trying in their usual rough manner to clear the streets, but they were ignored by the crowd. One Negro was saying to a policeman who was attempting to push him aside, "I ain't gonna move nowhere. That's the trouble now. You white folks is always pushing us around. Now you got your 38 and I got mine, so let's battle it out." As I walked toward the front porch, I realized that many people were armed. Nonviolent resistance was on the verge of being transformed into violence. I rushed into the house to see if Coretta and Yoki were safe. When I walked into the bedroom and saw my wife and daughter uninjured, I drew my first full breath in many minutes. I learned that fortunately, when Coretta and Mrs. Williams had heard the sound of something falling on the front porch, they had jumped up and run to the back of the house. If instead they had gone to the porch to investigate, the outcome might have been fatal. Coretta was neither bitter nor panicky. She had accepted the whole thing with unbelievable composure. As I noticed her calmness, I became even more calm myself. Mayor Gale, Commissioner Sellers, and several white reporters had reached the house before I did and were standing in the dining room. After reassuring myself about my family's safety, I went to speak to them. Both Gale and Sellers expressed their regret that this unfortunate incident has taken place in our city. One of the trustees of my church, who is employed in the public school system of Montgomery, was standing beside me when the mayor and the commissioner spoke. Although in a vulnerable position, he turned to the mayor and said, "You may express your regrets, but you must face the fact that your public statements created the atmosphere for this bombing. This is the end result of your get tough policy." Neither Mayor Gale nor Commissioner Sellers could reply. By this time, the crowd outside was getting out of hand. The policemen had failed to disperse them, and throngs of additional people were arriving every minute. The white reporters inside the house wanted to leave to get their stories on the wires, but they were afraid to face the angry crowd. The mayor and police commissioner, though they might not have admitted it, were very pale. In this atmosphere, I walked out to the porch and asked the crowd to come to order. In less than a moment, there was complete silence. Quietly, I told them that I was all right and that my wife and baby were all right. "Now let's not become panicky," I continued. "If you have weapons, take them home. If you do not have them, please do not seek to get them. We cannot solve this problem through retaliatory violence. We must meet violence with nonviolence. Remember the words of Jesus. He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." I then urged them to leave peacefully. "We must love our white brothers," I said, "no matter what they do to us. We must make them know that we love them. Jesus still cries out in words that echo across the centuries, 'Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you.' This is what we must live by. We must meet hate with love." "Remember," I ended, "if I am stopped, this movement will not stop, because God is with the movement. Go home with this glowing faith and this radiant assurance." As I finished speaking, there were shouts of "Amen" and "God bless you." I could hear voices saying, "We are with you all the way, Reverend." I looked out over that vast throng of people and noticed tears on many faces. After I finished, the police commissioner began to address the crowd. Immediately there were boos. Police officers tried to get the attention of the Negroes by saying, "Be quiet, the commissioner is speaking." To this, the crowd responded with even louder boos. I came back to the edge of the porch and raised my hand for silence. "Remember what I just said. Let us hear the commissioner." In the ensuing lull, the commissioner spoke and offered a reward to the person or persons who could report the offenders. Then the crowd began to disperse. Things remained tense the whole of that night. The Negroes had had enough. They were ready to meet violence with violence. One policeman later told me that if a Negro had fallen over a brick that night, a race riot would probably have broken out because the Negro would have been convinced that a white person had pushed him. This could well have been the darkest night in Montgomery's history, but something happened to avert it. The Spirit of God was in our hearts, and a night that seemed destined to end in unleashed chaos came to close in a majestic group demonstration of nonviolence. After our many friends left the house late that evening, Coretta, Yoki, and I were driven to the home of one of our church members to spend the night. I could not get to sleep. While I lay in that quiet front bedroom, with a distant street lamp throwing a reassuring glow through the curtained window, I began to think of the viciousness of people who would bomb my home. I could feel the anger rising when I realized that my wife and baby could have been killed. I thought about the city commissioners and all the statements that they had made about me and the Negro generally. I was once more on the verge of corroding hatred, and once more I caught myself and said, "You must not allow yourself to become bitter." I tried to put myself in the place of the three commissioners. I said to myself, "These men are not bad men. They are misguided. They have fine reputations in the community. In their dealings with white people, they are respectable and gentlemanly. They probably think they are right in their methods of dealing with Negroes. They say the things they say about us and treat us as they do because they have been taught these things. From the cradle to the grave, it is instilled in them that the Negro is inferior. Their parents probably taught them that. The schools they attended taught them that. The books they read, even their churches and ministers, often taught them that. And above all, the very concept of segregation teaches them that. The whole cultural tradition under which they have grown, a tradition blighted with more than 250 years of slavery and more than 90 years of segregation, teaches them that Negroes do not deserve certain things. So these men are merely the children of their culture. When they seek to preserve segregation, they are seeking to preserve only what their local folkways have taught them was right. Midnight had long since passed. Coretta and the baby were sound asleep. It was time for me, too, to get some rest. At about 2:30, I turned over in bed and fell into a dazed slumber. But the night was not yet over. Some time later, Coretta and I were awakened by a slow, steady knocking at the front door. We looked at each other wordlessly in the dim light and listened as the knocking began again. Through the window, we could see the dark outline of a figure on the front porch. Our hosts were sound asleep in the back of the house, and we lay in the front, frozen into inaction. Eventually, the sound stopped, and we saw a shadowy figure move across the porch and start down the steps to the street. I pulled myself out of bed, peered through the curtains, and recognized the stocky, reassuring back of Coretta's father. O.B. Scott had heard the news of the bombing over the radio in Marion and had driven to Montgomery to take Coretta and Yoki home with him, until this thing cools off. We talked together for some time, but although Coretta listened respectfully to her father's persuasions, She would not leave. "I'm sorry, Dad," she said, "but I belong here with Martin." And so Obie Scott drove back to Marion alone. Just two nights later, a stick of dynamite was thrown on the lawn of E.D. Nixon. Fortunately, again, no one was hurt. Once more, a large crowd of Negroes assembled, but they did not lose control, and so nonviolence had won its first and its second tests. After the bombings, many of the officers of my church and other trusted friends urged me to hire a bodyguard and armed watchmen for my house. I tried to tell them that I had no fears now, and consequently needed no protection. But they were insistent, so I agreed to consider the question. I also went down to the sheriff's office and applied for a license to carry a gun in the car, but this was refused. Meanwhile, I reconsidered. How could I serve as one of the leaders of a nonviolent movement and at the same time use weapons of violence for my personal protection? Coretta and I talked the matter over for several days and finally agreed that arms were no solution. We decided then to get rid of the one weapon we owned. We tried to satisfy our friends by having floodlights mounted around the house and hiring unarmed watchmen around the clock. I also promised that I would not travel around the city alone. This was a comparatively easy promise to keep, thanks to our friend Bob Williams, a professor of music at Alabama State College and a former college mate of mine at Morehouse. When I came to Montgomery, I had found him here, and from the moment the protest started, he was seldom far from my side or Coretta's. He did most of my driving around Montgomery and accompanied me on several out-of-town trips. Whenever Coretta and Yoki went to Atlanta or Marion, he was always there to drive them down and to bring them back. Almost imperceptibly, he had become my voluntary bodyguard. Though he carried no arms and could never have been as fierce as the name implied. In this crisis, the officers and members of my church were always nearby to lend their encouragement and active support. As I gradually lost my role as husband and father, having to be away from home for hours and sometimes days at a time, the women of the church came into the house to keep Coretta company. Often they volunteered to cook the meals and clean or help with the baby. Many of the men took turns as watchmen or drove me around when Bob Williams was not available. Nor did my congregation ever complain when the multiplicity of my new responsibilities caused me to lag in my pastoral duties. For months, my day-to-day contact with my parishioners had almost ceased. I had become no more than a Sunday preacher. But my church willingly shared me with the community, and threw their own considerable resources of time and money into the struggle. Our local white friends, too, came forward with their support. Often they called Coretta to say an encouraging word, and when the house was bombed, several of them, known and unknown to us, came by to express their regret. Occasionally, the mail would bring a letter from a white Montgomeryan saying, "Carry on. We are with you 100%. Frequently, these were simply signed, "A White Friend." Interestingly enough, for some time after the bombings, the threatening telephone calls slowed up. But this was only a lull. Several months later, they had begun again in full force. In order to sleep at night, it finally became necessary to apply for an unlisted number. This number was passed out to all the members of the church, the members of the MIA, and other friends across the country. And although it had sometimes been suggested that our own group was responsible for the threats, we never received another hostile call. Of course, the letters still came, but my secretaries were discreet enough to keep as many of them as possible from my attention. When the opposition discovered that violence could not block the protest, they resorted to mass arrests. As early as January 9th, a Montgomery attorney had called the attention of the press to an old state law against boycotts. He referred to Title 14, Section 54, which provides that when two or more persons enter into a conspiracy to prevent the operation of a lawful business without just cause or legal excuse, they shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. On February 13th, the Montgomery County Grand Jury was called to determine whether Negroes who were boycotting the buses were violating this law. After about a week of deliberations, the jury, composed of 17 whites and one Negro, found the boycott illegal and indicted more than 100 persons. My name, of course, was on the list. At the time of the indictments, I was at Fisk University in Nashville, giving a series of lectures. During this period, I was talking to Montgomery on the phone at least 3 times a day in order to keep abreast of developments. Thus, I heard of the indictments first in a telephone call from Ralph Abernathy, late Tuesday night, February 21st. He said that the arrests were scheduled to begin the following morning. Knowing that he would be one of the first to be arrested, I assured him that I would be with him and the others in my prayers. As usual, he was unperturbed. I told him that I would cut my trip short in Nashville and come to Montgomery the next day. I booked an early morning flight. All night long, I thought of the people in Montgomery. Would these mass arrests so frighten them that they would urge us to call off the protest? I knew how hard-pressed they had been. For more than 13 weeks they had walked and sacrificed and worn down their cars. They had been harassed and intimidated on every hand, and now they faced arrest on top of all this. Would they become battle-weary, I wondered? Would they give up in despair? Would this be the end of our movement? I arose early Wednesday morning and notified the officials of Fisk that I had to leave ahead of time because of the situation in Montgomery. I flew to Atlanta to pick up my wife and daughter, whom I had left at my parents' home while I was in Nashville. My wife, my mother, and father met me at the airport. I had told them about the indictments over the phone, and they had gotten additional information from a radio broadcast. Coretta showed her usual composure, but my parents' faces wore signs of deep perturbation. My father, so unafraid for himself, had fallen into a constant state of terror for me and my family. Since the protest began, he had beaten a path between Atlanta and Montgomery to be at our side. Many times he had sat in on our board meetings and never shown any doubt about the justice of our actions. Yet this stern and courageous man had reached the point where he could scarcely mention the protest without tears. My mother, too, had suffered. After the bombing, she had had to take to bed under doctor's orders, and she was often ill later. Their expressions, even the way they walked, I realized as they came toward me at the airport, had begun to show the strain. As we drove to their house, my father said that he thought it would be unwise for me to return to Montgomery now. Although many others have been indicted, he said, their main concern is to get you. They might even put you in jail without a bond. He went on to tell me that the law enforcement agencies in Montgomery had been trying to find something on my record in Atlanta which would make it possible to deport me from Alabama. They had gone to the Atlanta Police Department and were disappointed when Chief Jenkins informed them that I did not have even a minor police record. All of this shows, my father concluded, that they are out to get you. I listened to him attentively, and yet I knew that I could not follow his suggestion and stay in Atlanta. I was profoundly concerned about my parents. I was worried about their worry. I knew that if I continued the struggle, I would be plagued by the pain that I was inflicting on them. But if I eased out now, I would be plagued by my own conscience, reminding me that I lacked the moral courage to stand by a cause to the end. No one can understand my conflict who has not looked into the eyes of those he loves, knowing that he has no alternative but to take a dangerous stand that leaves them tormented. My father told me that he had asked several trusted friends to come to